This is Line One, your health connection, a weekly program produced at the studios of KSKA. Each week, KSKA's host, Dr. Thad Woodard, puts you in touch with local and national experts in a variety of health and family issues. Opinions expressed are those of the host, guest, and callers, and do not represent those of KSKA, the licensee, or the underwriters. Here's your host, Dr. Thad Woodard.
Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, Your Health Connection. My guest today is Dr. Charles Cowan. Dr. Cowan is the medical director of the autism program at Children's Hospital in Seattle. While he is here, he's been kind enough to spend some time with us, but he's also got some other obligations, particularly involving the public, I thought I might want to let you know about. Tonight in Wasilla at Evangelo's Restaurant, he'll be speaking from 6 to 8 p.m. Tonight, 6 to 8 p.m. at Wasilla Evangelo's Restaurant, and then here in Anchorage again tomorrow night from 6 to 8 at the Providence Cancer Center. He's also, for professionals, will be giving grand rounds at the Anchorage, at the Alaska Medical Center, Native Medical Center, at 8:30 tomorrow morning. Dr. Cowan, it's a real pleasure to have you join us.
Thanks very much, Thad.
I typically like to start with some definitions. That's always a good thing, I think, if you want to think critically. So let's define and talk about autism and what it really is, how we would define it, at least from a medical standpoint. And then also, if you don't mind, things that are in what is termed the autism spectrum disorders as well. And it'll help us understand why it may be difficult to really get a good handle on how much autism's out there sometimes.
Well, that's a great first question. Autism is a set of patterns of early child development and a set of symptoms. And in some areas in medicine, we're able to define things by things we see on an X-ray or in a microscope. And in other cases, we can only define things by what people tell us or what we see a child doing. And that latter category, things that we can't kind of measure in the laboratory or with a microscope, tend to be harder. And a lot of conditions that affect behavior and child development are in that category. So one of the struggles over time has been to try to understand why some children have an altered pattern of development. That altered pattern can be things like being slower in learning to walk, being slower in learning to talk, being slower in learning cognitive skills and intellectual kinds of activities or emotional problems. And these phenomena of development have been studied for many, many years. And we have a pretty good idea of what patterns of development when kids first start to walk and talk and do other things. What's interesting about autism, and I'm going to use the term autism spectrum disorders and try and define what that means in a minute, is that the history of observation of this began in the 1940s with two researchers, Dr. Leo Kanner at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore and Hans Asperger in Germany. And they both described kids that they called autistic. What the word autism actually means is alone. And they described kids with different kinds of aloneness. Hans Asperger's group of kids were alone in mostly in the social sense. They had trouble making friends. They had trouble developing personal relationships. And the children that Leo Kanner described were children who were alone in the sense of not being able to communicate, being, quote, in their own world, and seeming to have pretty little interest in interacting with people. But they could talk. That was kind of the big difference between these two populations. And at first glance, they seemed so different that nobody actually recognized that they shared similar characteristics. It was in the early 80s that some researchers in Great Britain figured out that there actually was relationships between these two, what apparently were very different groups of young people. And they sort of began the the understanding of what's called an autism spectrum. So what makes children with autism of any variety unique is that they have problems with learning communication, problems with learning social skills, and problems being adaptable or flexible. They tend to like to do the same thing in some way over and over again. And so both of the groups that were previously described as autism and that were described as Asperger's syndrome share to different degrees these characteristics. Those definitions keep changing. They get defined by a process that develops in psychiatry, what's called the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. And currently, the autism spectrum is kind of divided into three categories: autism, Asperger's, and something called pervasive developmental disorder not otherwise specified, which is way too long a series of words. We shorten it with PDD-NOS. And PDD-NOS is sort of that middle ground, those kids that aren't fully, that don't meet full criteria for autism and don't meet full criteria for autism. They're a group that's also called atypical autism. But the problem is that there still isn't universal agreement about how to define these different categories. And most importantly, kids change. So it's not uncommon to see a child at a young age who is in the pre-language stage. They don't talk at all. And then may develop speech at a much later age, sometimes 4, 5, even 6 years of age. And then if you happen to look at them at that age, you'd classify them differently. And if you continue to follow them into teenage years and adulthood, they may look differently as well. So the definitions being somewhat fluid and changeable, and there's not universal agreement about how to define these categories, we often are now using this term called autism spectrum disorder, which says you have some of these features, but not necessarily a specific classification. And there's also a lot of debate within our field about which classification. It's not uncommon to get a group of specialists together and we all kind of see different things. So it's been a very challenging condition to kind of pin down because of the fact that there isn't something you can measure. Healthcare professionals, docs like to measure things, draw blood samples and look at x-rays and say, oh, I got it. And this one has so far not been measurable, so that causes concern.
In an effort to try to make this clear, you've made it very clear, but I'm thinking about the listening audience again. The same thing really can now, I think, safely be said about asthma, but also diabetes. I mean, we think of diabetes as one illness, but now we know there's type 1 and type 2, and then there's variations of that. So even in a disorder where we can draw a line in the sand and make a definition and do a test, there's still the body responds in X number of ways to injuries. And what I hear you saying is these characteristics of people with autism, children with autism, fall within this range, but they may not all have the same disorder.
Oh, absolutely. That's absolutely true what you said about asthma and diabetes. And the other thing that actually affects our process of counting, of epidemiology, of figuring out how many people have a condition, is that with every disorder that I can think of, we've been able to identify earlier, milder, subtler forms of these problems that we previously wouldn't have recognized or counted in within that disease. We talk about pre-diabetic states or tendencies to have asthma. And if you start adding all of those people with those variations in, then you end up counting more people. And it seems like we now have an awful lot of children that we count as having autism, perhaps because we've added these subtler classifications in that we don't know exactly what they mean. until we watch these kids for a long period of time.
I would also say that, I mean, we're much better educated. I mean, we as science moves on, we learn more and more. Physicians are trained better, and so we're picking up individuals who are much more likely to fit these group of problems, whereas in the past, some of those patients may have been just said they have mental retardation. I'm just saying something off the top of my head. I think that's reasonably true. So would never have gotten classified as autism, and so we're off the radar when we look back and say, is autism increasing in prevalence?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. Mental retardation, or what we now call intellectual disability, is a perfect example. But there are actually some other interesting examples. So children that have something called Down syndrome, which I think many of your audience might know of, it's a chromosome abnormality that causes slow development. If we look at that population of children with Down syndrome, there's actually within that a subpopulation of children who look like they have autism, and particularly if you look at them through the lens of autism. In other words, you do a test that looks at certain characteristics like speech problems or social problems. And so you end up with some kids, it's maybe 10 or 15% of children with Down syndrome, who get two diagnoses. And there is actually a lot of overlap with other conditions, attention problems, attention deficit disorder, and a whole bunch of other terms that merge symptoms with this population. So that is another thing that confounds our ability to get a handle around it.
So to sum up, the best we know right now is that it is very hard to say for sure that the absolute prevalence of autism has increased in this country.
I'll have to give you a yes and a no answer to that.
That's why I asked the question.
No, it's a very controversial one, that I've actually spent a fair amount of time trying to get my own hands around. So let me answer this in two ways. There certainly is no doubt that as far as the counting exercise of counting the number of people that have autism spectrum disorders, there are a lot more now than there were. Number two, that we're using different criteria to diagnose them, and that we're diagnosing children a lot younger age. So even just adding a population of 2 to 4-year-olds who previously would never have been counted into that pool, we increase the numbers. Nevertheless, there still is a sense among both epidemiologists that we're not quite sure we can explain all the increase with these factors. It's just that nobody's been able to figure out exactly how much. It certainly constitutes a big component of it, these factors that you just mentioned, Dr. Woodward, and those that I just mentioned. So that's still an open question as to whether it's – if there really are a lot more. But, I think in some ways it's an irrelevant question because the issue is that we do define these children as having a problem. They deserve the best possible care, which is early diagnosis, early intervention, sometimes intentional sometimes intensive interventions. And so this is the reality now. We now have a prevalence of autism that the Centers for Disease Control says is 1 in 150. And providing services to that large a population, whether it's real or not, is not important. There are kids with problems that and families with problems that we need to provide services for. So that's the public health aspect that I think is important to understand.
Let's get to this early diagnosis. Certainly it makes sense intuitively that if you diagnose a disorder early, you have a better chance of perhaps affecting the outcome of that problem. So I remember, been in practice 30 years, at one point it was said, you'd pick these kids up by age 2, mainly because of language problems, and now I'm looking at kids around one with a couple of things I'm looking for, and I think I'm still behind the eight ball. So I want to ask the expert, how early should general pediatricians, people who deal with kids every day, be able to pick up the idea, get the suspicion that a child has autism?
Well, the probable optimal age is somewhere between 18 and 24 months. One of the problems is that the accuracy of diagnosis decreases the younger you are. The chance that you're over-diagnosing something at very young ages is higher, given our current tools. Our tools do keep getting better, but they're not 100% accurate. So there's a possibility of overcalling. The usual presentation of autism is a delay in language. And what we know about typical children's language development is that by age two, the average child has about 250 word vocabulary. It's surprising to people how many words little kids can use. And they're starting to put words together in small sentences like daddy go and buy mom and more cookies and simple little phrases. And so children that don't have that language development by age two are suspect. We can sometimes diagnose much younger kids if we have, for some reason, a suspicion. So often, if a family has an autistic child and then has another child, we'll tend to kind of look at those kids very carefully. But not all of the kids who subsequently get a diagnosis are identifiable at very young ages, because in many cases we have to wait until language develops, which is around age one, is when language first starts to develop. We also do look for some specific nonverbal signs like pointing and eye contact. So little kids little babies have many ways to communicate with their parents. In fact, the most common way that small children communicate, or one of the things that they do almost universally, is if they want to be picked up, they lift their arms up. So that's kind of that's baby sign language for, hey, mom, pick me up. They also do things like waving hi and bye around a year of age. Many kids, again, these are not absolute ages. Please don't get panicked if your kid isn't doing these things exactly on time, because kids vary a lot. But they do, without words, they greet and say goodbye to people by waving. And they also ask for things, usually by pointing or bringing things to someone, or in some way gesturing that they want something. That's how their parents know that they might be hungry or want some toy or something. So pointing is actually a very complicated exercise, and there's a couple of different kinds of pointing that babies do. One is a point to ask for something. Hey, mom, go get me that toy over there, which they do by putting their finger out and saying, or something like that. And sometimes kids point to show you things that they're interested in. So they just saw the airplane in the sky, or they saw the dog walk down the street, and they point and look at their mom or dad and say a long sentence in just that little action. Hey, mom, did you see that just walking there? What do you think about it? So there's a lot of communication that happens with gesture, and we do look out for that. And children who subsequently may have autism are slow in developing pointing skills, both mostly the kind of pointing to share interest and ideas rather than pointing to ask for something. So there are subtle things that we look at. Eye contact is another one, because eye contact is another kind of communication that doesn't involve words.
Okay. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection on KSKA. We're talking about autism today. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
Award-winning filmmaker Ken Burns presents his new documentary series, The National Parks, America's Best Idea, at the Alaska Center for the Performing Arts for one night only, June 18th. Ken Burns will share his experiences filming in Alaska and Alaska's majestic parklands. Information at 263Arts and CenterTix.net. In partnership with KAKM, proceeds from this event will support the National Parks Conservation Association and Alaska Geographic, who sponsored this announcement.
This is Line One. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Today we're talking about autism with Dr. Charles Cowan. Dr. Cowan is the medical director of the autism program at Seattle Children's Hospital. If you have questions or comments about today's topic and you'd like to participate, let me give you a couple of ways to do that. You can call toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. You can also call us directly, although that direct number is not sitting on my message board right now. You can also email us at lineone, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at kska.org. That's lineone, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at kska.org. And I'll give you the direct number again shortly. I should know it. I've only been doing this 10 years, but I'm 61 years old, and I forget these numbers without that help. Dr. Cowan, let's talk a little bit about treatment. I'm skirting around cause because I'm expecting some phone calls to bring that one up. But so we'll come back to that. What do we know about treatment? What are the long-term? You've kind of hinted at long-term outcomes can be variable. But let's talk about the typical autistic patient found early, diagnosed early, treated. What happens? What can we expect as a result?
Well, so I think I have to backtrack just a second and talk a little bit about how kids develop. So children don't need to be taught to talk or walk. They kind of magically, it's complicated, but it seems magic, are able to do these remarkably complicated tasks that we take for granted. And then once in a while, we confront a child who doesn't develop these skills naturally all by themselves, but needs some help. And the tools that we have for doing that are explicit teaching. So kids are not born with the capability of doing algebra or reading. They require somebody to explain these things, and they have to learn them by practice. Basic skills are learned without explicit teaching, except sometimes they're not. But nevertheless, the same rules apply. So to teach a child to talk or to communicate, you almost have to go through the steps of normal child development, doing things like teaching a child to look at you, teaching a child to point, teaching a child to make sounds and to form those sounds into words. And some kids learn these fairly rapidly, these stepwise skills, and some children learn them very slowly. But basically, it's the same principle. It's kind of a teaching process. Many different folks do that kind of teaching. Speech therapists, special educators, physical and occupational therapists all are, in some sense, teachers because they set up exercises that children and their families practice over and over again to achieve the skills. And we see a lot of variation. We see some kids learning these skills very rapidly. We see some kids learning these skills much slower. They all learn them. They all learn, but it's just at different rates. So the child's brain is rapidly developing both biologically at younger ages. So we at least think that kids' brains have the capacity to learn a lot faster at younger ages. So that's the logic of saying that we ought to start this kind of teaching and learning process as early as we can, identify where the developmental weaknesses are, and then try to address them. Sometimes it's a very arduous process, which can be frustrating because it doesn't happen overnight. But Nevertheless, the most recent research, which is just being, the data is just being analyzed, does suggest that those kids that get a intensive or at least some early intervention do much better in the long run. It's a little hard to predict what the specific outcome of a specific child is.
So each, and I guess the complexity of that answer is the complexity of the nervous system.
Yes, that's right.
It's just, I mean, we'd all like to say that if I have a child that's born with this spectrum of disorders, that I could do X and I would have a normal child, but that seems unrealistic.
Well, that is for sure the dilemma. But, you know, that's actually true about a lot of things about human medicine. There isn't, just as you described a little before, that asthma is a very complicated problem and so is diabetes, and that there isn't one absolute treatment and that we keep learning new treatments. The problem is the brain and the mind are very hard places to probe. It's hard to get tissue samples, and it's hard to get understanding of how it all works, and it's incredibly complicated. Your brain is certainly your most complicated organ. So we're just beginning to learn how it all works, and that's, again, part of the problem. It's unlikely that we're going to find a single answer the same way we're not going to find a single answer for cancer.
We do have a caller, and I'd like to take that caller right now. Jean, you're on line one.
Hi. I just have a comment regarding the earlier part of this discussion, that the diagnosis. I have a 61-year-old child that I'm sure has autism, and that a doctor has agreed with me. She was not diagnosed that way at the time. This was in Anchorage. There was one psychiatrist in town and one psychologist. They just told me she was retarded. But it was, your description is so perfect. I went to the doctor at about 18 months and said, there's something wrong with this child, and she isn't learning to speak. And he said, I have a kid 3 years old who doesn't speak much. I said, it's not that. She doesn't understand. For example, if I always say bottle to her when I give her a bottle, but if she doesn't see the bottle, she keeps on screaming even though I say the word. She really doesn't understand any words. And the comment is that fits so perfectly, your description of the time and exactly what the first observation is. But when I had later children, I became convinced I could have known there was something wrong with the child earlier, because she didn't like to be held. She didn't like to be cuddled. And she never looked at my face. She tended to look off other places. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if that is something that is being used to diagnose earlier.
Absolutely. You've hit it right on. Eye contact is a part of the communication system. We human beings look at each other's faces to understand what the other person is thinking and feeling. And there's actually a lot of brain research that shows how all of this works and how the eyes and understanding what facial expressions are all about it is a part of the communication system. And this is indeed one of the things that we see, is children can't look at people well, or they do it poorly. But remember that it's not an all or none phenomena. I think one of the things that you mentioned that you experienced with your daughter was that she didn't like to be held. And in fact, for a long time, people said, well, if your child is affectionate, if they like to be held, they can't be autistic. And that's not true. It's a matter of degree. What children often do is want to be held for their comfort, but they're not quite interested in giving you comfort back. It's kind of a one-sided comfort. And also, many children with autism have what are called sensory processing issues, or They are either under or oversensitive to touch, smell, sound, vision. And so sometimes for some of these kids, being touched is like putting your finger in an electric socket. It's very uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And for others, it's just the opposite. They actually like to be touched. And if anything, touched intensely, like being squeezed and roughhoused and rolled around, that actually makes them feel better. So it's all kinds of these things.
And, you know, she still doesn't like to be touched to this day. She now, actually, somewhere along in her 50s, suddenly said one day, "I love you, Mommy," which just absolutely astonished me. Of course, it was after I'd scolded her. But she doesn't really like to be hugged or anything like that still. So, and I know other autistic children who do, so I agree with you on that, too. Anyway, I know you've got other callers, so I will get off the line.
Yeah, Jean, thanks for your comments.
You're welcome.
Bye. Let me remind our listeners again that you're listening to Line 1, and let me give you the local number that I should know by heart that I don't, 550-8433, 550-8433, if you'd like to call and ask a question or make a comment. One of the things that struck me about Jean's comment is that I think she said her child was a daughter, and it's my understanding that autism is much more common in males, and I'd like your comment on that and then maybe get you to think about causation here a little bit by suggesting or asking why would this be more common in males? What does it tell us about what the cause might be?
Another great question. Well, there's no doubt when one looks at the epidemiology, when one does the counting of people, that about 4 to 5 times more boys are diagnosed with autism than girls. And there may be a number of possible explanations for this. It certainly could imply a genetic mechanism because boys and girls differ in a number of ways genetically, not just the fact that they have X and Y or XX chromosomes. Their boys and girls' brains are different, actually, in some ways. And there have been some very interesting studies that have looked at the difference between men and women and how well they understand facial expressions. And it turns out, not terribly surprisingly, my wife tells me this a lot, that men don't kind of get emotions and facial expressions as well as women do. So one of the reasons that there may be more boys is that kind of inherently the male brain is less socially capable than the female brain. That doesn't mean, again, it's not an all or nothing. It's a degree of difference. And so in some ways, being female may be protective against the milder forms of autism. And in general, that is something that we see, is that often the girls that we see seem to have more severe symptoms, maybe because we don't know how to detect the subtler problems in the female population. But another one of those mysteries, and it's also true, women are the stronger gender, as we all know, in terms of many health conditions, heart disease and a number of things. Certainly for behavioral issues, there are differences between men and women. So boys have a lot more attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD.
Is the fact that there are more boys with typical autism than girls also continue in the Asperger syndrome and the pervasive developmental disorders and other autistic-like disorders? And again, I'm kind of searching for the idea. What is this telling us about what's different about the brain?
Yeah, I think that there are in pretty much any subcategory. And I think one of the problems with a lot of the subcategory analysis is getting agreement on which category you fit in and which age group you're in and when you've done that. So a lot of times it's just easier to lump everybody together than to look at separate categories. But I think the other thing is that we're beginning to recognize subtler problems, we are diagnosing more girls with Asperger's syndrome. But that's not the general rule. In fact, some of the early studies said that the difference between boys and girls with Asperger's was even greater. There are a lot more Asperger boys than there are Asperger girls.
Okay, we have another caller. Roger. Roger, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Well, I'm 71. When I grew up, I was hyperactive and all this other kind of stuff you're talking about. I've never had friends in my life. The only friends I have now is my sons. I don't care to go out and meet people. I don't go, and I've been told by psychologists that I need friends. I don't think I do. I get along well without them. I'm happy with myself. And I still have problems, but I deal with them. I've been to anger management, which helps some, making me realize that I'm half the condition. And this is, I just wanted to mention this, that so when people look at their children and they can kind of make a assessment of what's going on, so they might want to see or seek medical assistance in some of these cases, because if there's a difference between parity within the human population, especially when they're younger.
I think that's a great, great comment, Roger. Well, I was going to say that one of the dilemmas with this population is recognizing who is normal and who we've decided by some arbitrary criteria is not normal. And in some ways, one of the trends that's happening is to give a diagnosis to just about everybody, because in some ways we're different. Everybody is. And I think that it is important to acknowledge that normal is a very broad range of behaviors and capabilities. Rather than saying that everybody is, there's something wrong with everybody, I think that it's really important to say what is right about everybody. And you don't have to, people that have only a couple friends or what some people might call introverted, doesn't mean there's anything wrong with you if it's okay with you. The problem with kids with autism are that at some level, they seem to be suffering in some ways. They're not necessarily happy. Sometimes they have behaviors that suggest that they're really very unhappy. And then I think it's not necessarily okay to say that this difference is something that is, quote, normal and we can ignore it. And the other thing is that I think I look at this from the point of view of being a parent, and that what a parent's job is, which is a very hard job, is to give all of our children as many tools in their toolbox, and then they grow up and they have their own lives. And so the capacity to understand other people, to develop personal relationships, is an important thing in most human beings' lives. And so if we see that some kids are struggling with doing that, then I think it's okay to try and help them. It doesn't mean that we say there's something wrong with them.
Amen.
All right. Thanks for your call, Roger. I appreciate it.
Thank you much. Bye-bye.
Let's get back to causation. I'm sitting here thinking there's increased risk in boys compared to girls, and I think I'm right about saying that once you have one child with autism, you're more likely to have other children with autism, which really begs the question that genetics seems to be playing a role. So what's the latest and best ideas about the cause?
Oh, it's a fabulous question. Thank you. A very hard question to answer. First of all, you're absolutely right. There's no doubt that autism is, in some factors, a genetic disorder. And in fact, it's probably, of all the kind of mental health and behavioral problems that plague human beings is probably the most genetic. And we know that from studies of twins. So if you look at identical twins, their concordance, their agreement of having autism, don't always, not exactly the same degree of autism, is very high. Sometimes over 90% of identical twins will have some degree of autism if one of them has it. Whereas if you look at twins who are fraternal from two different eggs and don't have the same genetic makeup, their risk is of both having autism is much lower, around 10% perhaps. So that white right away says, boy, this must be a genetic problem, but it's not clear that it's entirely a genetic problem. And the search for the gene or genes that could have caused this is still ongoing. So far, there's been 15 or 20 different sites on the on the genome that are identified as potential hotspots for autism risk. And the latest research, which is still pretty new, utilizes a pretty high-tech device called a DNA chip that screens all of your genes at many different sites. And that research has begun to show that there are subtle changes in the genetic structure of autistic children of a substantial percent, maybe 30%, maybe more, that have extra pieces or are missing small pieces of chromosome material. We don't exactly know what that means, and we certainly don't know if that is in fact a cause. And so the reason why that's really important is, and it does get back to this question of, is there a real, I'll put that in quotes, increase, is that the genetic makeup of us humans doesn't change rapidly. It happens very slowly. So if there is a lot more autism, if this is a real phenomenon, it does imply that there is something else going on, a trigger, something in the environment. So when I say environment, that ranges from biologic agents like viruses and bacteria to chemicals to other environmental factors. And there are reasons to be concerned about our environment. Our environment is a lot more polluted in many ways than we are happy acknowledging. There are thousands of chemicals out there that could be doing something. The child's brain is kind of like the canary in the coal mine. It's maybe a very sensitive place where environmental factors may be playing a role. And so I think that it would be irresponsible to say that all of the autism prevalence is explainable by genetics. There's a fair chance, and this is true of lots of disorders, we keep coming back to diabetes and asthma. There are certainly environmental factors that are part of that mix, because we are what we inherit from our parents genetically, and then we change. So even explaining the difference between the severity of autism in identical twins would say something else is happening in development or post-birth development that may have an environmental role, because why is one child worse than another?
Let me give you some phone numbers again. We're going to be on for about another 15 minutes or so if you've got questions or comments. The local number, 550-8433, 550-8433. A toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And you can reach us at line one, LINEONE, at kska.org. And just a reminder, if you listen to this program between 8 and 9 tonight, it's a rebroadcast. And you can also have and invite friends to go to kska.org and listen to the podcast at any time, or you could share that link with individuals who you think might benefit from what they're hearing today. Let's at least address the issue that seems to be, in my mind, over, and that is vaccines as the cause.
Clearly a controversial question. Not controversial within the healthcare community, but quite controversial in the public. So let me explain how we know or don't know things, how we kind of figure out truth. And I put truth in quotes. Epidemiology, which is that counting thing that I was talking about, is a very powerful tool for understanding what's happening. And so our best ways to know whether vaccines are in fact related or not related to autism is to do some counting of those people that have had vaccines, had certain numbers of vaccines, and those that have not. And there have been many, many studies all around the world. Those studies have happened in Europe, they've happened in Japan, they've happened in the United States. And every time they do that, they fail to see a connection. For a while, there were concerns about the mercury additive thimerosal, which was placed in certain vaccines to help prevent bacterial contamination of those solutions. And there was concern that mercury could be a cause of autism. It turns out that mercury-containing vaccines were removed from the supply in Canada years before they were in the United States and Denmark, even earlier. And in both of those countries, the prevalence increase in autism did not decline or change after thimerosal was removed from vaccines. In the United States, all the thimerosal-containing vaccines were removed from the supply for all intents and purposes, except for a very few vaccines, starting in 2001. So if mercury or thimerosal was a cause of autism, then one would logically say we've taken away this cause. We should see a decline in prevalence. And we have not seen a decline in prevalence. So this is one of those issues that inspires a lot of family concern, and a lot of talk on the internet and talk shows, etc. But we do have to attempt to understand it in some logical way. And the other thing that I would say is that childhood vaccines have been one of the triumphs of healthcare. I, like you, Dr. Woodard, old enough to have seen epidemics of measles, of meningitis. I had friends growing up who had polio. I'm so happy as a doctor that I don't have to see children suffer with those health conditions. And so there's, when you kind of look at the benefit to vaccines has been enormous. Nevertheless, you know, we can keep doing things better, and I think it's not unreasonable for people to raise questions, for people to say, gee, what about this? And then the best that we can do is study it. And I think we have studied it as thoroughly as we know how. And so far, it doesn't seem like it's a risk factor. That doesn't say that there are not environmental risk factors out there, whether those are environmental mercury or a whole lot of chemicals that deal with plastics and on and on and on, that could be causing disease.
Another issue that I think we should address, or I would like to see addressed, is the issue of individuals, some physicians, some non-physicians, some celebrities, who say they can, for all intents and purposes, cure or make an autistic child normal again. That's a terribly unethical thing from my point of view. What's your comments on this?
No, I agree. And in fact, there is really right now, there is an ongoing study sponsored by some high-powered universities, and I think they have a little NIH money, to try to actually find such children, to identify kids who have been cured quote unquote, of autism. And so far, they haven't really found them. It seems to me that if you are a provider of health services and you have a treatment which is effective for what for many families is a devastating health problem, and then to not scientifically share that information, to not collect data, to not expose your ideas to the research of other people, then that is extraordinarily unethical. And in fact, that's been one of the problems, is that the folks that have made these claims really can't back up their claims with numbers and haven't subjected their research to other people's scrutiny. You know, if there's some truth out there in any of these things, I would be the first person to grab onto it, because it pains me a lot to see children and families suffer. So I wish that were true. I read all of those literature. I study those reports with a great deal of effort. And so far, I am unconvinced that these are answers. That's not to say that some of those treatments might help some of the problems. A lot of these kids have sleep difficulties and intestinal problems. And sometimes some of the diets or additives appear to make kids better. But it does not affect the speech and communication and social problems that this population of kids have. And I've yet to see it. And I've seen, I don't know, 1,000 or so kids with autism. I'll keep looking.
Reminder, just once again, Dr. Cowan's going to be talking at Evangelo's Restaurant this evening from 6 to 8 p.m. That's in Wasilla. It's open to the public. Tomorrow, a public forum from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Providence Cancer Center. And then for professionals, Grand Rounds tomorrow at 8:30 in the morning. I had an email that says, if vaccines are not part of the autism problem, then why does autism occur mostly at the same age, 17 to 24 months or so? I would answer, and I'll let you answer, but why isn't it the thought that maybe it's the dog that licks them, the food they pick up off the floor? Why would it have to be only vaccines if it happens at 18 to 24, 17 to 24? We've already talked about it. It may be present well before then. It may have been present before there were vaccines. We talked to a 61-year-old, or mother who had a 61-year-old. So anyway, I don't know why we would jump the vaccines out of the blue anyway. Anyway, go ahead.
Well, I can't answer whether it's the dog or not. Actually, if you look at the prevalence curves of cell phone use, I could argue right. that autism is caused by cell phones, because there's a lot more cell phones.
Yeah, they go up together. They occur together.
The curves, the amount of use. So maybe it's microwaves or who knows.
Yeah. Okay.
There has to be a plausible mechanism. Plausibility is an important factor to understand. And the reason why autism symptoms appear at those ages is that's when kids start to talk. That's the normal time. And so if you haven't noticed the subtler cues early on, like the pointing and eye contact, and some kids don't even display those abnormalities at earlier ages, and then they're not suddenly talking, then it's not unreasonable for families to have gravitated to this. I don't want to blame people for having speculations and wonder. I think that's your job as a parent, to protect your child and find the best kind of health care and opportunities. But it just hasn't seemed to pan out. And the best that we can do to answer that is we keep trying to look and we don't find it.
So kids have autism that have never been immunized.
Kids have autism that have never been immunized. In a nice study in Montreal, actually looking at the MMR vaccine, measles, mumps, rubella, the prevalence of autism in that population who didn't have who had MMR was actually lower than the prevalence. There was a small difference between those kids that had not gotten it. So you would think it would be just the opposite if indeed it was causative. The numbers are small and maybe not completely statistically relevant, but we can look at all of those things. We can look at kids who haven't had any vaccines, and their rate of autism is the same as those kids that have gotten vaccines. That's our best logic. We can only rely on some kind of scientific evidence and logic to answer these questions.
We have a caller, and she asked about effective treatments, and I'm going to just ask you to talk about effective treatments because I don't know that we've got time for her to ask her question and so forth. But we've mentioned treatments a little bit. She can go back and listen to the podcast again later. But tell us what kind of treatments are we talking about specifically that we know have some benefit but don't cure?
So the most effective treatments have been educational and behavioral. There are a number of techniques, one called applied behavioral analysis, another technique called floor time, which is popular on the East Coast of the U.S. These are all basically teaching strategies, teaching children to communicate, pay attention, have eye contact. A lot of repetition is involved in those teaching. There are no real biologic treatments, drugs, chemicals, injections, anything that I think has shown to be of benefit, though some families do find that certain diets, actually their kids seem to be calmer and have less sleep or GI problems. And those are very interesting phenomena that we need to investigate. There was an interesting report not long ago that showed that kids with high fevers seem to get better when they're having high fevers. So something is happening. These all ought to be investigated. But the most effective treatments are early intervention, school-based programs, therapy.
Any last comments? We just got a couple of seconds. I'd like to let you sum up what's the most important things you want people to remember.
The most important thing I want people to remember is to pay attention, to learn the early signs of autism, to pay attention to early communication in babies, to ask your health providers to help. Let's not have the story too much more of the woman who had a 62-year-old son who felt that she wasn't listened to by her doctors. Moms and dads are the best sources of observation we have, and you should insist that your children are looked at if you're concerned. There are resources, early intervention resources in the community that you should access. And I also just want to put a plug in quickly for the Alaska Autism Resource Center. That
I forgot to mention, that's a local access for information and treatment.
Yeah, they've been our host. They've been our host, and they've been wonderful.
Thanks again, Dr. Charles Cowan, for being our guest today. Next week, we'll be discussing hospice, so tune into your health and learn more Monday, April 27th at 2 p.m., repeating the same evening at 8 p.m. on FM 91.1. For KSKA and for Line 1, this is Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
This has been Line 1, your health connection. If you have questions or comments concerning this program, write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508, or email us at line1@ksKA.org. Additional information on today's show topic, including relevant website links, will be posted along with audio of today's program on our website at ksKA.org/line1. CD copies of this program can be purchased by calling 550-8400 during regular business hours. This is KSKA, Anchorage.